Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing writer-director Andrew Haigh's Lean on Pete, as well as hearing from the film's lead, Charlie Plummer, who plays Charlie, a teen living with his single father, who finds work caring for an ageing racehorse named Lean on Pete. I'm Sam Howlett, and this week I'm joined by a man who may have written for Little White Lies and runs his own blog, but get off your high horse and join us, Campbell A. Campbell.
Oh, nay, I don't like that. Hi.
And once again joining us, our regular podcast collaborator, back in the saddle this week, Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And making his pod debut, a man who has written for Little White Lies, Vague Visages, and Hey You Guys, it's Alistair Naiman. Sorry, Alistair Bayman.
It's okay, I'll get off my high horse, seeing as it's my debut.
Those took years off my life.
Thank you for indulging me with that, everyone. And thank you for having a really good name for a horse pun.
No problem. Just thank my ancestors. It's okay.
So, Lean on Pete is based on the novel by Willie Vlautin, who co-adapts the screenplay. It's Andrew Haigh's fourth feature film, following the success of Greek Pete, Weekend, and 45 Years, his first adaptation and his first film outside the UK. Are we all Andrew Haigh fans in the room?
Big.
This is actually the first one I've watched.
Shame.
No, so much to look forward to.
Yeah, I know.
So excited. So much sadness.
Yeah. So much sadness and pain.
45 Years had the kind of has the unfortunate privilege of being in my Netflix queue, and things typically don't go there. It's like purgatory for my podcast. So that's one thing, and then it's just one of those things I've just never got around to. So I thought I'd start with this one, and it's a good one to start with. Yeah. I think all of his films are heartbreaking, very subtly directed musings on how horrible humanity is. Then I'm all in.
Well, I think there's hope. There's elements of hope
there's
in there.
Bit.
I don't
more
think
so
it's
in
all
Weekend.
Despair. Yeah,
just a little bit.
So this film premiered at the Venice Film Festival last year, where Charlie Plummer won the Marcello Mastroianni Award for Young Actor and Actress. And since then, he's been seen in Ridley Scott's All the Money in the World, and I spoke to him at last year's London Film Festival in October. We're delighted to be joined by star of Lean on Pete, Charlie Plummer. How you doing?
I'm good, man.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a bit about who you play in Lean on Pete, a bit about Charlie?
I play a character also named Charlie, who moves to the small town, our small area of Portland, Oregon, and with his single father. Mm-hmm. He's moved around for most of his life, and he moves there, you know, hoping to start anew and hopefully set some roots in this new location. And he does a little bit when he gets a job at this horse racing track and befriends this one horse. Yeah. And then what follows are a series of pretty tragic, upsetting events throughout the course of this young guy's life.
Okay. And what kind of person did you get from the script that Charlie was?
I got that he was a compassionate person, that he was one who was unbelievably strong, especially in the face of extreme adversity, and one who is quite isolated and alone a lot of the time, and really seeking for a home and seeking for a family that he loves and can trust.
Sure. Okay. So I didn't know this, but the film is based on a book that I wasn't familiar with at all. Were you familiar with the book, and have you read the book since at all?
I was not familiar with the book, and yes, I have read the book. That would be pretty funny if I was like, no, I didn't even bother. No, I definitely read the book, and I hadn't been familiar with it before, but as soon as I read the screenplay and then found out I'd be doing it, I mean, even after I read the screenplay, I ordered the book before I even found out I got the part or anything. And then I happened to get the part before I got the book to my house. So that was just good timing, I guess. So after I got the part, then of course I immediately started reading it. And it was really helpful in terms of just, because a lot of the character, a lot of the story for the character is pretty internalized. And so getting to kind of hear what is going on inside his head, and it was just really helpful. And I think helped my performance a lot.
So apart from the book, what other kind of preparation did you do? What kind of research did you do to get into character?
I spent about 3 weeks before we started filming in Portland, and I was working with the horse every day and the trainers that work with him. And, you know, while we were filming, I would talk to a lot of people who grew, you know, who have spent their lives in that environment and the racetrack kind of world. And and then, you know, the rest of it was really my prep really just came from having conversations with Andrew and, you know, not to talking too much, but there wasn't any rehearsal period. There wasn't any, you know, real adventures that we took before filming that would help us get into character more. It was really just, you know, start working. And I think we quickly fell into a rhythm with the story and the character, and that the rest of it was really just for the cameras.
Yeah. So you mentioned there the horse, of course. What was it like filming with the horses, and had you had any experience with horses before?
I had not had any experience with horses before, and it was really wonderful working with the horses. I loved, especially the main horse who plays Pete, this horse named Starsky. He was a great guy. He was really sweet and kind, and so smart. I mean, horses in general are very smart animals, but especially Starsky, emotionally, he was really intelligent and could pick up on what people were feeling and whether you were confident, whether you were nervous, and he would reflect that in a lot of ways. So it was a great experience for me, you know, as a human being. It was very fulfilling to get to work with a horse, and it was a great experience. But also as an actor, I think, you know, having your scene partner be someone who demanded you to be honest in every moment is really cool.
Sure. Okay. So you mentioned, did you film all on location then in Portland?
Not entirely. Oh, no. I'm trying to think. We almost, We did shoot entirely on location. I was trying to think if I got that mixed up with something. but no, we did shoot entirely on location, which I think also really helped the film. I think as soon as you, and especially with Andrew's films, you know, you sit a lot, just you, just the audience, and maybe one or two characters, and you're really just sitting with them. And so a lot of the time you're taking in everything about that environment. And I think whether that comes from, you know, just the way the chair looks or the way your eyes look. I mean, it's just so the audience is forced to pick up on everything. Totally. And I think that really, I love that about his films, and that was a quality that I really connected to. But I also really applaud, you know, the production designer and the cinematographer, Magnus, and so many people who worked on the film, because I think that they all play such a huge part in the storytelling for this film especially.
Sure. And so I guess like in the film, you have these people that just come and go very kind of quickly. So like Steve Buscemi and Chloe Svengi and then Steve Zahn, they sort of just come and go. What was it like on set having these big actors come in for a little bit and then go? Did you film it like in sequence, in order?
So. Yeah, we pretty much did. Okay. Pretty much. The only part that we didn't film in sequence was this section in Denver, which is with Steve Zahn's character.
Right.
That was shot a little bit before technically he would have been. But I felt so grateful to, and I do feel so grateful to Andrew that he allowed us to do that, because I think especially for this film, I think in any film it'll help no matter what, but I think especially when you're following one character, it's really, really helpful to, you know, be every step of the way on that journey. And a lot of films don't have the ability to do that just based on production and the means of it, but I thought Andrew, I think he made a priority that what happened. And I was so grateful that it did, because, you know, especially when you are working with these people and they start to come and go and come and go, and then eventually there's not anybody left. You know, it really does leave you with such a feeling that I think the character is also really feeling.
And what was Andrew like to work with?
He was a dream, man. I mean, honestly, you know, I wouldn't be lying about that. I loved working with him. Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of his films can tend to be kind of bleak and honest and in every way and difficult to watch. But he is such a charming guy, and I just loved working with him. He's such a sweet guy. He really cares about what he does, and he's such a smart person too.
Yeah.
And you know, he was an assistant editor for a long time, so also his background really, you know, makes it where he's very confident in what he wants and what he knows he needs. And so much of the time, you know, he won't do a take more than he needs to, and he won't do too many setups if he doesn't need them. And I think as an actor, that's the greatest thing to have in a director.
Okay. So this isn't your first film as a lead. You've been in King Jack, you were pretty much leading that. But this really felt like you were not only in every scene, but almost in every shot as well. What is it like? You know, it's still very early in your career, I suppose. What is it like having that kind of carrying the film, as it were? Do you feel the pressure, or is it kind of...
I think, you know, especially with this story, I love this story so much, and I love the book, and I love the script, and I love the characters, so I felt, especially the central character, I loved so much, and so I did feel a responsibility to do right by that, and I also felt a responsibility to Andrew, because I just love his film so much, and I really wanted to do right by him as well. But, I mean, whether it's, you know, the lead in the film or one scene, you know, I put a lot of pressure on myself to do as good of a job as possible. I think it's actually easier because when you're in every moment of the film, you don't have a lot of time to think about the pressure and think about, you know, how big it could be. I think when you just are tasked with having to do it every moment, you know, it just becomes a part of your life.
So
it never really feels like, you know, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is so crazy, yeah. This is so much, or what if I mess up? It's just like you have to show up and do it, and that's it.
And this is your second time appearing alongside Steve Buscemi in something. Mm-hmm. When you were, you know, younger on Boardwalk Empire, did he give you any advice, or was he kind of...
He's not mentor? The advice giver, you know, which I actually really think is great, because I think, I mean, I'm sure he has given me advice, and I mean, quite honestly, when I say he's not the advice giver, I don't mean that he's not a huge mentor for me or a huge cheer, because he is. I just mean that he's not the kind of guy who would sit you down and have that kind of conversation. I think the greatest advice he could give is in the way that he treats other people, in the way that he is composed on set. And so for me, from a young age, getting to watch him just be so generous with his time and be so present with people and kind, and as an actor and, you know, just as a person in general, it was really inspiring, because, you know, being in that position where, you know, you're in frustrating situations, you're in tough working environments, you know, you're on locations that are really crazy and tough, and to keep that composure and to really, you know, keep in mind that you're just working with other human beings, and that's all. And he just is such a great example of someone who is so compassionate, and I think that really reflects in his performances most of the time. So
of course we mentioned it there, Boardwalk Empire. What was it like to kind of grow up through the production of Boardwalk Empire? And have you watched it since? Because I assume at the time you weren't
no,
of age to watch it.
It's funny, I haven't really watched it, but that's only because I don't like to watch myself, and I also don't. I'm not a big TV guy, so. You know, but it's funny because, you know, there's so many of my favorite actors who are on that show. I think like Michael Shannon, Jack Huston being on that show. Even like Patricia Arquette was at the end of the show. And obviously Kelly MacDonald, and clearly Steve. And I mean, the level, Michael Kay, you know, you can go on and on. But I mean, I felt really fortunate to have that be one of my first experiences with film.
Right.
Being around on a set in which those actors were walking in and out, and in which Terrence Winter was the guy kind of driving it, and it's even if in the moment I wasn't taking all that in, you know, I think in retrospect, it absolutely contributes to the stuff that I'm able to do now, and I also just think, you know, that was a show in which almost everybody on that crew was just so kind and nice and really smart and cared about what they were doing. And I feel like that's been a pretty consistent point throughout my career and the people that I've worked with. So I felt, you know, it is really cool that is a part of my career in some way.
So I have to say congratulations on winning the Marcello Mastroianni Award.
That's right.
I've definitely butchered the pronunciation
no,
there.
No, you're kidding me.
But congratulations. So you now, you join a list of names that include Jennifer Lawrence, Mila Kunis, Ty Sheridan. Does this feel like a really big precedent to the start of your career, winning this award? And does it feel like now you're kind of being pushed forward, per se?
No, I mean, it's a huge honor. It really is. And I think, like you said, to be mentioned with those names, and also just to be mentioned with Marcello Mastroianni, who's such a phenomenal actor and a very important part of Italian film history, and I would say world history, film in general, world cinema. But I think, you know, I mean, it is such an honor, and at the same time, yeah, I think the best guidance I've ever gotten is, you know, to really ask yourself why you're doing it and why you're acting. And I would never, ever say that I want to act because I want to win awards.
Yeah, sure.
And because, I mean, I'm not just saying that. That's really truthful.
Yeah.
And while it is a huge honor, and especially historically being associated with those names, and really just the Venice Film Festival, too.
Yeah.
So many. It's the oldest film festival in the world. So to have your name, I mean, it's such a cool thing. But it's never anything where I'd want my career to be defined by that kind of a thing.
Okay.
And, you know, it's never the kind of thing I would seek out.
Sure.
But
awesome. Charlie Plummer, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, enough horsing around.
Or fouling around.
Excellent. Let's kick things off then with Charlie Plummer. So what do we make of him in this, which is very much his, you know, star-making performance for him?
He's very vulnerable, and I kind of just wanted to protect him in his little cherub face.
Yeah, I think that was the point.
He gives this really kind of quietly heartbreaking performance, and you can kind of tell that there's a lot of stuff simmering, but he's kind of got this lovely, quiet politeness, kind of masks this kind of pride and inability to kind of just give himself over to people, and it's really heartbreaking to see him make all of these wrong decisions, and I think he carries it really, really well. This is kind of quiet suffering.
Yeah, he kind of comes out a lot in his interactions with Pete, more so than any other human being, I think. And like the asides he kind of gives in the desert are truly heartbreaking, where he's just talking about he just went round to his mate's house, had some like Gatorade, and just like had a really cool time, you know. And that's all he wants from life. He just wants a home and stability. But life has played him a cruel card, and he just can't a cruel hand, sorry, and he can't get it.
Yeah, I think it's more about that than, I guess, his wrong choices. I think he's just doing his best, you know, to like sort of get through this world that has sort of let him fall through the cracks. And yeah, and I think the pride thing is also something that I thought was particularly heartbreaking, because he talks about the fact that like he'd rather them think that he's okay than have to see him the way that he's living at the moment, which is so sad.
Yeah.
This movie broke me. Broke me.
I think I was the most I was into it was in the first third, when it was kind of setting up these circumstances, when it wasn't, because it kind of shifts later on into this overwhelmingly heartbreaking mode, or like kind of teeters on the edge of that. But in this first act, well, all of it's strong, but in this first act, I thought it was particularly amazing, where it was just him getting by, and you can see all of these remnants of like his past life from when he's been moving around with his father. There's things like his quote unquote career as an athlete, and you just see all of these symbols that he's just clinging onto as best he can. And all of this scraping by is what started affecting me the most, because it's a very unvarnished portrayal of this kind of living. And there's so much detail in all of that that it feels very real, whereas it moves into this more emblematic mode when it turns into this Odyssey Across the West kind of thing. Which is also good, but for very different reasons. Sure. I just think that a lot of Plummer's best work comes in that first third. Because you see a lot of the attitude that we see more overtly later on just kind of simmering under the surface in that first bit, which I thought was he's really incredible.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fact that they're on this odyssey through the West. So what do we think of this film in terms of it being a sort of modern Western or a neo-Western?
It's kind of peculiar thinking that, like, what else is out in cinemas at the moment? Varishka Grishpark, is that correct? A Western that's more so kind of very self-referential in its kind of tropes of cowboys and stuff like that, whereas this is kind of, it's like an off-kilter. It kind of develops into a Western when it gets into the middle section of the film.
Yeah.
But then kind of outside of that, it does go into, like, social realism and stuff like that. So it's kind of, I think Haig and obviously the original novelist is aware of them tropes, but I don't think it kind of seeks to be a true Western. No. It just kind of happens. Charlie stumbles into the desert with Pete and yeah, like some beautiful cinematography unfolds.
Well, also an interesting point that I listened to him speak about on another podcast, Andrew Haig, is that it's almost like a revert, like, you know, sort of this idea of people moving west towards freedom, you know, the last frontier, the American sort of myth. The story's sort of a reverse of that. So he's moving from west to east, and he's not particularly looking for freedom, but he's looking for stability and sort of security that, you know, he's so desperately in need of.
In terms of it being a Western, I just found, especially considering the social realist aspect, I just find it really interesting that a lot of directors that kind of self-reflexively use this genre come from outside the US, especially with, Western being in the cinemas, Lean on Pete.
Yeah.
Things like Andrea Arnold's American Honey and, that was the one I was thinking of, Hell of High Water as well. Even though it's more action-packed, it's definitely more the unseen side of America, like wide open frontier stuff and how people kind of scrape by in that region. It's just, it seems that a lot of these people are more interested in approaching this genre without the unseen, it represents the kind of unseen demographics rather than it being a dusty action movie or something.
Yeah, definitely. Even Sweet Country that came out a few
months
ago.
Yeah, the Australian one. Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah,
that very much has this kind of, the director, Warwick Thornton, obviously knows that he's using Western imagery, but is doing something totally different with that. And even going back to like Sergio Leone, he's kind of, those spaghetti westerns are almost deconstructing the kind of the John Ford.
Yeah, they really humanize all the characters. Kind of like even seeing like A Fistful of Dollars a few weeks ago, I was kind of surprised at how deep it goes into the characters rather than it just being these gunslinging, cool-looking dudes.
What I found really important about the film is that Charlie never rides Pete.
Yeah.
He never gets on the horse because, the horse is kind of, you said earlier that the West is this kind of, this metaphor for freedom, and I think the horses as well, this sort of dream that you just get on your horse and ride into the sunset, and this doesn't happen here, and it feels like Charlie can't ride Pete. It just feels like that would be really against everything the film is saying,
seemingly against Charlie's philosophy as well, because the reason he frees Pete is because he doesn't view him as just a tool. He's he kind of is an emotional tool. He's a crutch for this poor boy. But it seems that riding him would just be this kind of violation of this, well, I say unspoken because one can't speak because it's a horse, but this unspoken pact between the two of them, it seems like it would be a violation of that. Yeah. And it kind of ties in with this deconstruction of the myth of like the Western, especially like you said, with it being a symbol of freedom to ride to the new frontier. But this boy walks slowly across the frontier, which is shown to be desolate and... Yeah. Horrible. Well, not horrible, but, you know, people are lost in it.
And I think Charlie sort of also is sort of trying to be that, like, look after the horse in a way that he isn't being looked after.
Yes.
You know,
this
sort of, like, tenderness and caring and, you know, he's treating him with, you know, how he would, like to be treated in the world, and sort of writing him, I think, would be problematic. That's how he's seeing it, you know?
Yeah, it's, I mean, they're both runners. It just seems that he invests so much of himself, he projects so much of himself onto it that, I don't know, I guess he kind of tries to rescue it in a sense that it's kind of wish fulfillment for himself, like seeing as someone might just like take him away from this fate, bad hand that he's been dealt. I don't know where I was leading with that.
I also heard Andrew Haig describe Charlie as a skittish horse himself, you know, the sort of like wide-eyed sort of kid who's just sort of going, rolling with the punches and trying to, I don't know, make sense of his surroundings.
I think we're projecting onto the horse now.
And the horse is less about escape for Charlie, maybe, as he needs this, he needs just something to care for, I think, and he needs to have this burden to care for the horse, because he'd be much more successful in his escape without the horse and his escape from his life and moving on. But the horse is, he needs the horse to, yeah, like you say, like a crutch to cling onto. He needs this burden to look after the horse.
It's kind of, it's like him hanging on to just the very last thing that he has. Clinging to whatever he has to kind of say that he's fine. Like, I'm fine, I've got the horse. and it did remind me of of Bicycle Thieves in that kind of sense. So the kind of the man and his son, like desperately looking for like kind of the tool of his trade, the bicycle, when really, if you kind of think about it, if he spent as much time maybe just finding a new one, he'd be slightly better off by the end. But it's more about how, one, it's just kind of everything he has, he's so desperately clinging on to it, just this one possession, like the thing that's his. And then it also turns into a thing about the poor being pitted against one another. But yeah, I mean, it's an emotional crunch.
Yeah, I think you've hit on something there with, I thinking of Bicycle Thieves, I just can't get that scene out of my head where the dad sees the bike and he goes to steal it. And then you've kind of got this little boy, just like, there's a similar scene in Lean on Pete, which just evokes such a pure emotion. Mm. And just kind of, it's shell-shocking, but also kind of deeply humane, the way they both depict the characters. And then that interaction in Lean on Pete, when that big scene happens, you know, it's kind of, it just completely blows your mind in the most saddest way.
So let's, you mentioned before we were recording, Cam, about Free Willy.
Childhood favourite.
Yeah. But let's talk a bit about the fact, the animal in the film and animals in film in general, and what this does differently with that sort of relationship between not just human and animal, but also like young, disillusioned child and animal.
I mean, I wonder if it's part of the fact that the animal can't talk back to them.
There's so
many movies where it's just a young person who has nothing and kind of projects everything onto an animal that's in a similarly dire circumstance. But I guess most of those are very much meant to be tear jerkers and really tragic things. And I guess with Free Willy, if I'm remembering it right, it's an orphan who is kind of being bounced from house to house, and I guess he just wants to offer the orca the same kind of freedom that he wishes for, instead of just being confined to involuntarily confined to this new home, which actually isn't too bad. But but I guess the difference between something like Free Willy and Lean on Pete is that it's not so much about the connection between boy and animal as it is about the dependency on this one symbol, but like basically just teetering over this abyss of despair in the case of Lean on Pete. I can't believe I'm going deep on Free Willy right now.
Dive in.
Because I guess with that, the boy is kind of this plucky, rebellious child, whereas Charlie just wants to fit in and he just wants wants the visage that he's fine, I guess.
Oh my god.
It's also just about you know these kids sort of articulating their own thought processes by like talking to the animal that can't talk back to them. It's almost them trying to find out who they are and what they think, and you know,
it's therapeutic.
And it's like, you know, searching for an identity, I guess, and these animals sort of are a sounding board for their coming of age stories, you know.
which makes Plummer's performance all the more heartbreaking because he's so open with this one thing, and you can see how much he's holding back the rest of the time. There's only like one other interaction like this in the film, like the ones he has with the horse, like a completely honest.
Yeah.
There's only one other one, and it completely and utterly destroyed me.
I think that kind of tear-jerking element doesn't really come through in the score by James Edward Barker. It's kind of quite soft and ambient, and it doesn't kind of overplay any emotion whatsoever. And it's kind of, I was taken aback by how little it's used. I think there's like a sound of diegetic music where they're like going to the first racetrack, but then it kind of just flutters around and
it
kind of
just floats above the film for a while. It doesn't. I don't recall there being any non-diegetic sound until like something like halfway through. And it kind of, and the score just comes in a really lovely way, and it's not in a moment that's obvious. It just kind of comes in, and it feels like it's always been there, and it just kind of floats over the couple. I think it's kind of it from one scene to another for a bit. It's not really like a montage, but it stitches these two things together in this really wonderful way, and it doesn't overplay its hand or like steer the audience in any one direction. It just kind of. It's very much, since the film's so matter of fact, you just feel how you feel, I guess.
And James Edward Baker, he actually wrote a score for Weekend, but Andrew Hay cut it completely and decided to go without a score. So 45 years, once again, had no score. So this is his first film for a while that he's decided to go with a score, which I think is an interesting decision.
That's interesting.
It's so strange because just off memory, I thought there was a score in 45 years.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's because that film is so, it's so compassionate towards its characters, and I'm thinking of that scene in particular with Charlotte Rampling, where she discovers the projection of Tom Corney's. Tom Corney's former lover. That feels like that's got kind of a similar score to it. But that's so strange that doesn't even have a score. I'm not spoiling anything. It's kind of in the synopsis.
Movies don't really
MGB.
Have spoilers.
I know. I was literally just about to say as well that I feel like it's because Haig is so invested in characters and talking.
And the reality of it.
Yeah. It's more about them portraying these feelings. And it's strange to see a film like this where it's like a kind of subtle, quiet film where there's so much... I don't know, where there's just so much talking between characters, you kind of expect it to just be this montage of Charlie shuffling around like Charlie Brown style. it's an interesting choice because he picked probably the most hyperverbal American actor I can think of in Steve Buscemi.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
I think that the score, as you said, stitches together these moments, but I think it's a nice sort of idea because I saw the film as sort of these vignettes of, you know, who Charlie interacts with throughout the film. You know, you get to see sort of the portrait of what kind of life is like for working class middle America, you know, and the dissension into maybe a less known or, you know.
Definitely like when the Odyssey starts, when it's...
Yeah.
Is where he comes across these kind of... It's interesting because at the beginning he kind of runs through... When he's running through that area, he runs through this kind of blue-collar working neighbourhood, and then he basically does... So that's just his lifestyle for the first act, and then it turns into that, but just more drawn out and prolonged. It's really interesting about how, like you said before, how it portrays how easily people can just kind of slip through the cracks. You can see... you can just as easily see people like the veterans falling into similar circumstances.
It was forgotten.
Charlie sees later.
And because, even that girl who encounters, that's kind of a real like deep scene because she's just like, oh, it's quite easy to get stuck.
Yeah.
And it's kind of not silly to think that in an alternative universe where Charlie has kind of an evil dad or something like that, that this happens to him, you know. It's kind of, even though it is very specific to Charlie's interactions with the horse, it kind of feels it like this, just slipping through the cracks could genuinely happen to anyone.
I do like that he didn't have an evil dad. I appreciated that he was well-meaning, but you could see how kind of careless he was, and he was forever kind of teetering on the brink. And there's so many little things like he can't really seem to hold on to a job. He provokes people.
He can't really cook.
He loved his son. He just didn't know how to care for him. You know. Mm. Yeah.
Which is a kind of similar dilemma the Florida Project brought up.
Yeah.
You have a mother who does love her daughter and
wants
to be a good mum, but just can't bring herself to do it the best for the daughter, to do it the right way. You've mentioned Steve Buscemi already, but there are a lot of kind of big actors that have very small roles in this film dotted around, which I really liked. And I think this is the biggest cast that Andrew Hoeks have. It's interesting how he uses these big actors like Steve Buscemi, like Klaus Fenge, like Steve Zahn. What do we think of those in it? Were they distracting at any point? Did they take you out of the film? Did they just fit right into this universe?
I thought, Buscemi might be the one to take me out of it because he's got such a distinct persona, but I thought it fits in really well because he's normally this very irritable character, and they kind of twisted it. I guess he was kind of funny, but they...
He's playing against type, I think.
Him as this very surly...
cynical.
What do you call him? Stable handler kind of dude? I'm not really sure what is
he's
just, called.
Yeah,
he's a
trainer.
Horse guy.
He's a dodgy horse guy.
And he does say at one point that, like, you know, at one point he also liked horses, and you just get the sense that his life has beaten all the good, all the happiness out of him, you know, like, just to get by, just to sustain himself.
I want a Dell prequel now.
Well, funnily enough, Steve Buscemi's first short film was called What Happened to Pete, so who knows. But kind of going back to the performances, I think Chloe Sevigny as Bonnie, similar to what you said with Del and how kind of a character is built within a line of dialogue. She's just talking to Charlie about how she worked at Red Lobster and she broke her back and stuff like that, and you just get an awful, awful lot just simply from them two talking to each other. I was kind of waiting for Buscemi to become this kind of father figure to Charlie the first time I saw the film, and I was like, well, no, wait, this is not happening. Like, the moment he kind of buys him a grilled cheese and curly fries, I was like, yeah, this dude is just not gonna,
it's so unsentimental, the whole film is so unsentimental.
I love that it throws out any kind of possible like romantic thing where something like Free Willy would go.
It's not the Hollywood blockbuster version of this film.
Every opportunity it just lets you think that this is how it is in these movies where kids meet animals, and it very much steers away from that, like with Del's unsentimentality, and even Sevigny doesn't really they all take pity on Charlie, but they don't go out of their way when it comes to helping him, and neither does anyone else really. It's like the just unsentimental version of whatever these movies are, which is, I thought, a really great heartbreaking touch.
And Steve Zahn as well, playing
a drugged up
that was Steve Zahn.
It's a really deep kind of sequence. I initially thought first time that sequence didn't work because it kind of overextends what happens after Lean on Pete and Charlie disappear, but it really works second time around because it kind of just gets you more into that world, because it's kind of the first true urban setting we get, you know. It's like cityscape and stuff like that. Like, I don't particularly know where it is, but it's definitely not the blue collar working class environment. It's more a little bit, you know, there's definitely a Starbucks on the corner block, so it kind of just furthers and deepens this world. Which
I think what you're saying, I'm still in the kind of first viewing mode. In comparison to the rest of it, which is a very subdued film, I thought it was quite a lot. At the same time, I really enjoyed it.
Appreciated.
Yes. No. I really appreciated its view of how these systems end up pitting people against each other. This kind of horrible scrabble to the top of not very much.
That's interesting. I didn't see it so much as like pitting them against each other, rather than like they're the kind of the consequence of this sort of way of life.
That's kind of what I mean.
Yeah.
A consequence of the system.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like in something like Florida Project, it ends up, it kind of pushes people into these corners, and then they kind of have to fight their way out of it.
Yeah, or just fight to survive, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yes,
and they're just kind of forgotten about, and the system, you know, doesn't care about them.
Yeah,
as
I don't
much
think
as
there's
they claim
any,
to.
You know, there's not a cop car in. Well, no, apart from the people who Charlie ends up talking to because of one way or another. But yeah, there's a distinct kind of lack of any.
Well, there's kind of there's many times that he comes into contact with sort of institutionalized authority, and in all of those instances, it's kind of threatening. Mm. Well, not threatening, but you get the sense that, like, even with a doctor or the police that he kind of comes into contact with every now and then, you don't trust them, or you get the sense that they don't really care about him. He's kind of just this problem that they fob him off onto something else.
There's a sense there's no one looking out for anyone.
Yeah. I guess this is where the Western stuff comes in. Like,
in
a world without law.
Without law. Yeah. So, for sort of wrapping up then, how do you think this sort of develops Haig as a storyteller, or how it kind of be seen against his other films and as his career is progressing?
I'm just kind of constantly in awe of how, like, dexterous he is as a director. Like, you kind of think with Weekend, he even said it himself, he's going to be this gay director, and then he just comes out with something like 45 Years that I can't wait for you to see it. I just can't wait.
So
but he's just so... the cliche of it's an open road. Like, you genuinely don't know what Haig's going to do next, but it's kind of in the best possible sense. It's not like, I'm scared for this guy. Like, you just know whatever he does is just going to bang, literally.
It's got some bangers.
Yeah.
Absolute bangers.
I'm excited to go through his filmography. I think I can't really speak for Haig's kind of... expanding on his work, but I think it's really interesting in the canon of people moving to the West and exploring that frontier as, something as that being not all it's kind of said to be. I think Lean on Pete's a really great extension of that, and I don't know, it's nice to have a neorealist film with Steve Buscemi in it.
Yeah. So Lean on Pete, which is out and is also available on Curzon Home Cinema as well, along with a film we discussed a few weeks ago, Let the Sunshine In, so do check those out. Andrew Haig's curated collection is also available on Curzon Home Cinema, so that includes Cleo 5-7, Code Unknown, Morven Kalar, Together, Unrelated, Climates, and of course 45 Years. So now's your chance, Cam.
Yes.
No excuses.
Everyone watch Morven Kalar too.
Yeah.
And Cleo, of course, for Agnes.
Of course. If, like us, you are keen on Pete or not, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com and we can read out your mini review on next week's show. And as ever, subscribe, leave a review and comment. We're available on iTunes and Acast. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. That's goodbye from Campbell Campbell.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from... pod debut Alistair Bayman.
Thank you. I'm going to go and hit the hay after.
You'll be back. And goodbye from Kelly Powell.
Goodbye.
Got a horse pun in you?
No.
Oh,
I've got one here.
Sorry. I told you the movie broke me. Isn't that kind of a horse pun?
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Second time, it's like so much better because you know where it's going.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.